Today, we're going to study the last chapter of the book of Leviticus, and we're going to bring it to a close. And I'm going to review and repeat a few things we discussed last time. Now, it's interesting that the final few matters talked about in Leviticus revolve around funding the sanctuary. From a biblical perspective, the operation of the sanctuary, what at this point in Israel's history is that wilderness tent, would later on be a fixed building, the temple. It would be funded from a number of sources. And this chapter deals with the several major categories of sanctuary funding. Pledges of silver and animals, consecration of real property like houses and land, giving of firstborn animals and first fruits of crops, and then donation of property and tithing. There's that T word. Now, what we find out as we read this chapter is that in general, the goal was for the priesthood who operated the sanctuary to more often than not obtain silver so as to purchase whatever was needed for maintenance and operation. Therefore, we will see a schedule of values drawn up in which various pledges of land and animals and even people could be exchanged for silver. That is, the idea was that a vow would be made to give thus and so to the sanctuary. That person would then turn around and redeem, buy back, whatever it is that he has given. How much it would cost, to redeem these things? That's one of the matters this chapter deals with. Now, we also need to realize that this is looking ahead to the time when Israel was settled in the land and living a very different kind of lifestyle than the nomadic one that they were currently experiencing. Common sense dictates that Israel's circumstances would be radically different once they conquered Canaan and they had a permanent home. And this is a good example for us to note that it is the principles of the law that we need to be more cognizant of than some of its finer details, because they tend to deal more with cultural and geographical matters as they existed at that moment. But those are fluid things that change as time passes. So let me be clear. The rules and the regulations contained in Leviticus 27 are constructed in a way so to make it the norm that most of this of what the sanctuary received was silver, money, something that was easier for them to exchange than animals or produce from field crops. Now, before we read chapter 27, just let me point out a couple of things. First, this all ought to sound very familiar to us. That where we worship, synagogue or church, is typically funded like this. Churches and synagogues tend to lump all giving into to the institution together, and they call it tithes or offerings. But Leviticus breaks down the way the institution is funded into more detailed categories, among which tithing is just one. Second, just so you'll be thinking about it as we read it, recognize that the subject of tithing, per se, is not discussed in the New Testament. It's only lightly alluded to. And the number of times that the word tithe is even used in the New Testament can be counted on one hand. Even more, when it is used, except for one time, it's in the context of making a point about a Torah principle, or speaking about the merit of one of the patriarchs. The point is this. Absolutely no command is given in the New Testament to tithe anything. Thus, many believers have taken this lack of a direct New Testament commandment to mean that Christians don't have any requirement to tithe and therefore have no requirement to support the institution. Of course, I can't think of any church or synagogue that would subscribe to that notion. Now, I don't want to detour. I don't want to discuss tithing in depth, but I want to throw out a couple of thoughts for you to think about. I'll begin by giving you the bottom line. Tithing and giving to support the institution was assumed in the New Testament. In other words, the New Testament was never to be taken as some do, that if Jesus didn't directly command it, we don't have to do it. For one thing, don't ever think that all of Yeshua's words were recorded. In other words, we have just a few pages in our Bibles dedicated to quotes from Messiah. And he lived for how long? About 33 years. He ministered under the power of the Holy Spirit for at least 3 of those years. So I don't think I have to work very hard to convince you that the vast majority, how about 99.999% of everything he spoke was not recorded. And as I have made it clear over and over again, as Yeshua taught, he must have had an inkling that some might think that if he didn't repeat every last detail of the law, well, that it must have meant that he was doing away with it. So, in Matthew 5:17, right in the midst of his most famous oracle called the Sermon on the Mount, he reminded folks that not only did he not come to abolish the law, but not the slightest detail of it was going to pass until when? Heaven and earth passes away. The Torah had already established the principle of tithing and scores of other principles as well. And Jesus wasn't going to spend his time on earth repeating everything that had been long established by his Father as immutable principles. See, this is just one good example of what I've been teaching you over these years, that it is assumed that the New Testament reader already had a good background in these fundamental matters covered by the law. After all, the Torah was 1,300 years old by the time Yeshua arrived on the scene. It was still the basis for existence and behavior and the religious system of the Jewish people. Jesus didn't explain tithing because there's no need to explain it. He didn't command tithing because there was no need. Tithing in its many forms was long established. Every Jew knew what tithing meant and the many kinds of giving that were expected of them, how the system operated, what its purpose was. So with that as a background, let's read Leviticus chapter 27, the final book in the final chapter, rather, in the book of Leviticus. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 143. Adonai said to Moshe, "Tell the people of Israel, if someone makes a clearly defined vow to Adonai to give him an amount equal to the value of a human being, the value you are to assign to a man between the ages of 20 and 60 is to be 50 shekels of silver, with the sanctuary shekel being the standard. If a woman, 30 shekels. If it's a child, 5 to 20 years old, assign a value of 20 shekels for a boy and 10 for a girl. If a baby, one month to 5 years of age, 5 shekels for a boy, 3 for a girl. If a person past 60, 15 shekels for a man, 10 for a woman. If the person is too poor to be evaluated, set him before the Kohen, the priest, who will assign him a value in keeping with the means of the person who made the vow. Now, if the vow is for the value of an animal of the kind used when people bring an offering to Adonai, all that a person gives of such animals to Adonai will be holy. He's not to exchange or replace it by substituting a good animal for a bad one or vice versa. If he does make such a substitution, both the original animal and the one replacing it will be holy. If the animal is an unclean one, such as may not be used in an offering to Adonai, he must set it before the priest, and the priest is to set a value on it in relation to its good and bad points. Value set by the priest will stand. But if the person making the vow wishes to redeem the animal, he must add 1/5 to the valuation. When a person consecrates his house to be holy for Adonai, the priest is to set a value on it in relation to its good and bad points. The value set by the priest will stand. If the consecrator wishes to redeem his house, he must add a fifth to the value that you've set on it, and it will revert to him. If a person consecrates to Adonai part of a field belonging to his tribe's possession, you are to value it according to its production, with 5 bushels of barley being valued at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field during the year of Yovel, Jubilee, this valuation will stand. But if he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, then the priest is to calculate the price according to the years remaining till the next Jubilee, with a corresponding reduction from your valuation. If the one consecrating the field wishes to redeem it, he must add 1/5 to your valuation. The field will be set aside to revert to him. If the seller does not wish to redeem the field, or if the treasurer for the priests has sold the field to someone else, it can no longer be redeemed. But when the purchaser has to vacate the field in the Jubilee, it will become holy to Adonai like a field unconditionally consecrated. It will belong to the priests. If he consecrates to Adonai a field which he has bought, a field which is not part of his tribe's possessions, then the priest is to calculate its value according to the years remaining until the year of Jubilee. And the man will on that same day pay this amount, since it is holy to Adonai. In the year of Jubilee, the field will revert to the person from whom it was bought, that is, to the person whose tribal possession it belongs. All of your valuations are to be according to the sanctuary shekel, 20 gerahs to the shekel. However, the firstborn among animals, since it is already born as a firstborn for Adonai, no one can consecrate, neither ox nor sheep, since it belongs to Adonai already. But if it is an unclean animal, he may redeem it at the price at which you value it and add a fifth. Or if he does not redeem it, it is to be sold at the price at which you value it. However, nothing consecrated unconditionally, which a person may consecrate to Adonai out of all he owns, person, animal, or field that he possesses, is to be sold or redeemed, because everything consecrated unconditionally is especially holy to Adonai. No person who has been sentenced to die and thus unconditionally consecrated can be redeemed. He must be put to death. All the tenth given from the land, whether from planted seed or fruit from trees, belongs to Adonai. It is holy to Adonai. If someone wants to redeem any of his tenth, he has to add a fifth. All the tenth from the herd or the flock, whatever passes under the shepherd's crook, the tenth one will be holy to Adonai. The owner is not to inquire whether the animal is good or bad. He cannot exchange it. If he does exchange it, both it and the one he substituted for it will be holy. It can't be redeemed. These are the commandments which Adonai gave Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. Well, this narrative begins by talking about vows to the Lord. And the remainder of the chapter continues to discuss vows and how to deal with whatever it was that was vowed. Now, this can all sound a bit hard to untangle, but what it really amounts to is this. Men have historically made rash promises to God, especially when they feel threatened or in danger, or we really want some. And as my father, a World War II veteran, used to say, there's no atheists in foxholes. So people who have never even considered God or his commandments before, at least, when they get into mortal danger, sometimes just in very serious difficulty, suddenly find religion. And they start making vows, promises to the Lord, if he'll just get them out of whatever hopeless situation they find themselves in. Some years ago, I recall watching a hilarious movie called The End. It starred Dom DeLuise, who's a favorite of mine, and Burt Reynolds, so-so. It revolved around a mental facility and a couple of really wacky guys who took turns living there. And towards the end of the film, Burt Reynolds decides he's going to kill himself by wading into the ocean surf and then swimming out to sea until he's finally beyond the point of no return. At which point, he would be unable to save himself, so he he's going to drown. Suicide. Well, the camera follows him as he walks into these salty waters and he fights his way through the oncoming waves till he reaches the calmer waters on the other side. At that point, he starts swimming like mad towards the horizon, all the time talking to himself about all of his troubles. And as luck would have it, by the time he's tiring and he just can't swim another stroke, which was, of course, the goal in the first place, he suddenly realizes maybe his problems aren't all that bad after all. You know what? Now I don't want to die. So he turns back. He looks at the distant shore. Panic sets in. Figures he's never going to make it. And the first thing he does, as kind of a knee-jerk reaction, is he looks up and he shouts to heaven, "Lord, I'll give you everything I have, everything, if you'll just get me safely back to the beach somehow." And as he continues to swim and struggle, the slightest glimmer of hope starts to overcome him. And so he stops for a second to rest, and he again shouts to heaven, "Lord, I'll give you 90% of everything I have, if you'll just let me live." Well, quick burst of energy now, and he propels himself even nearer to safety. And in a growing confidence that he's going to make it, he stops for a moment to catch his breath and he says, "Lord, I'll split it with you. I'll give you half of everything I own if I'll just make it to the shore." Well, the swimming and the bargaining continues all the way till he reaches land. He's exhausted. He tumbles out, staggers out of the water, rolls over on his back full of sand, and he looks and says, "Thanks, God. If there's ever anything you need, let me know, and I'll see what I can do about it." Pretty true, isn't it? That's about as good an illustration as I can think of to explain what's going on in Leviticus 27 and all this bargaining. The Hebrews made vows to God all the time, especially when they were worried or they were scared. It's just part of their culture. At other times when they were in a particularly pious mood, you know, like when we've just sung a really emotional song, they might promise God something that was kind of impulsive. And very often these vows, well, they weren't particularly well thought out. Pretty soon they regretted making them. In those days, vows weren't only public. They were made known to the priests, and they were accompanied with ritual, so everybody knew about it. So, were these folks stuck with their rashly made impulsive vows to God? You bet they were. However, you could legally redeem them. You could buy them back. Your vow could be bought back for a price if that vow involved giving the Lord property that had value. Notice that a vow always includes giving God something of value. Promising to be obedient henceforth is just fine as long as it included a gift to God of proper worth. Typically, the vow involved an item with a value that could be reasonably set. And then the redemption price for it was 120% of that item's market value. Now in verse 1, we find that the item of value, as part of the vow, was a human being. Now, don't get the idea that a man is offered a slave that he owns. Rather, this is a case where a person offers him or herself. And what is actually being offered is that person's service to the sanctuary or to the temple. Now, in reality, giving service to the temple was only even rarely possible. See, this was because God had ordained that only Levites and priests could do that. Only they could serve at the temple. An ordinary Jew couldn't do that. That's not to say that an ordinary Jew who made such a vow couldn't work for a priest outside of temple duties, you know, mow his lawn. But that's not generally what happened. That's not what was being contemplated here. Were there other means of entering God's service but not being attached to the temple? Yes. We get examples like Samson and Samuel, both being vowed to service to God in the form of a Nazarite vow. Yet the form of their service did not involve temple service, but rather service in different ways, in their cases as judges and prophets, by being dedicated to God. Since in most cases, this person who vowed himself to the sanctuary service was not going to ever be able to carry out the vow because he was restricted by regulation from doing it. Therefore, the only avenue open for them was to redeem the vow for a price. And verses 3 through 8 explain how the priest was to arrive at a proper evaluation of the amount of money for that person who took the vow to come up with in order to redeem himself, so to speak, in a nutshell. Men from 20 to 60 years of age had to pay 50 shekels. Women of the same age, 30 shekels. Boy children from 5 to 20 years old had to pay 20 shekels. Girls of the same age range, 10. Infants and toddlers from a month to 5 years, 5 shekels for a boy, 3 for a girl. An elderly person over 60 years of age, 15 shekels for a male, 10 for a female. Now, this may not sound like a lot, but let me tell you, it was a substantial amount of money. In this era, the wages for 1 month's work was about 1 silver shekel. So it cost a mature male better than 4 years of wages to redeem himself from a vow of service to God. Think of 1 shekel as 1 month as you look at this list, and you kind of get the idea. Rabbis call this chart of values set down in Leviticus 26 as the principle of equivalence. Now, actually, we've seen this concept of equivalence before. We've seen it in the presentation of certain kinds of offerings to atone for certain kinds of sins. We've seen it where a person must present in silver shekels 120% of the value of a ram as a guilt offering, for instance. Now, it might upset some of you ladies to see your equivalent in money is generally from half to two-thirds that of a male. On the other hand, what we can take from this is that women were allowed to make vows to God on their own. And the children were pledged, boys and girls, for service to God by their parents. So we must never go so far as to think that Hebrew society nor the laws of Torah made women or girl children worthless. Yeah, this really was a male-oriented society, but women had rights and they had value, and men had duties towards them. Further, when it came to a woman's relationship with God, she could have one with God on a personal basis, as is expressed by her ability to make a personal vow. And starting in verse 9, as we move from redeeming pledged people to redeeming pledged animals, the idea was that a person could pledge an animal as part of his or her vow offering, then turn around and redeem that animal back. The cost to do it, though, was 120% of its value. In other words, a 20% surcharge was added for a person to redeem an animal that they had pledged. Now, a logical question would be to ask, who sets the value for these various animals? Answer, the priesthood. And in many ways, this represents tremendous power being vested in the priesthood. After all, whatever the priests decided was the proper value for an animal surely must have now carried over to the marketplace for animals. It would have a big effect on it. There would not have been one value for for an animal offered up and another for the same animal bought and sold in the everyday transaction. So the priests were administers of justice, and they had a hand in setting the market price for animals along with their temple duties. Now, the idea behind verse 9, where it says that any animal brought as an offering to the Lord may not be redeemed, simply brings us back to a principle we learned several months back, the principle of holy property. Where it says that this animal is holy, it means that it becomes God's holy property. So the reason this animal can't be redeemed is because it's already been transferred to God. And once it belongs to God, there's no getting it back. And a person who would attempt to do such a thing would be violating God's holy property, and the penalty for that's death. Further, a person who designates an animal for a sacrifice as part of a vow can't later substitute it with another animal, not even an animal of greater value. Another part of the principle of holy property is that at some point in the process of the owner determining which of his animals he's going to offer, it's a done deal. And this can be before he even brings that animal to the temple. In other words, the choice of animal to be given can simply be a mental decision upon which no action has even been taken yet. But at that point of decision, the animal becomes God's holy property. If a person should try and make a substitution, the priest is instructed to keep both animals. Why? Because now both have been devoted to God. Both are now holy property. Now, the first animal discussed, since it was suitable for altar sacrifice, was by definition a ritually clean animal. And verse 11 talks about a ritually unclean animal being used for a vow offering, and we see that for some reason that's perfectly acceptable. Automatically, however, it means that this animal will be exchanged for money. Since the unclean animal can't be used for sacrifice, nor can the priests eat it. And as a standard, a 20% surcharge of the animal's value is added to the cost to redeem it back. Verse 14 shifts from redeeming human and animal life to redeeming inanimate objects. And the word used up to now to designate these humans and animals as vow offerings changes. The term changes to consecrations. In other words, these things are set apart for God, not necessarily as part of a vow, but more as a free will gift offering. Thus, if someone consecrates his house, but wants to get it back, costs him 120% of the market value. Next is what happens if someone consecrates land. The value of the land is determined by what the potential crop value will be. And we've learned that in earlier lessons. Of course, we saw this in chapter 25 that deals with Jubilee. Further, even though it is the sanctuary that's operated by the priest that gets the benefit of the land, the laws of Jubilee still apply. The price for redemption of land by its owner is based on the number of years worth of crops that it'll produce before the next Jubilee. And upon the year of Jubilee, the original owner gets his land back. Then we get an interesting footnote in verse 25, that the standard for paying the redemption money will be what's called a sanctuary shekel. Now, what this means is twofold. Number one, the content of the shekel coin is to be silver. And two, the precise weight shall be 20 gerahs, whatever that is. The situation was this. Anybody could mint their own coins in those days. And they could determine the coin's content, what kind of metal they used, the weight of it. The first coins used for money were basically just blobs of silver that while the metal was still hot and pliable, a signet ring got pushed down into it to identify that coin's owner. Eventually, most kings and potentates made their own coins for use in their kingdoms. But unlike today, where the metal content of a coin has little or nothing to do with its actual value, ancient coins were simply convenient, predetermined amounts of silver and gold. So a one shekel coin theoretically contained one shekel's worth of silver. A 10 shekel coin contained 10 shekels worth of silver, so on and so forth. So here in Leviticus 27, it is set down that one shekel was to consist of 20 gerahs, 20 grains, which is the measurement. Somebody else could have determined that their shekel was 15 grains or 18 grains or 10 grains, whatever they wanted it to be. So someone would come to the tabernacle to pay their redemption price with a handful of coins or even just silver nuggets. And a priest would weigh it. And based on a standard of 20 gerahs or 20 grains of silver equaling one shekel, the Israelite would pay the proper number of shekels to redeem whatever it was he was redeeming. Many years later, during the first temple period, Solomon's temple, the priests actually minted temple coins. By the late second temple period in Yeshua's day, when the entire priest and temple institution had become kind of corrupt, the only way someone could pay for redemption or to purchase a sacrificial animal was with coins minted by the temple. So Jews would come from all over the Roman Empire with perfectly valid coins from wherever they were from, but then they were forced into exchanging them at the temple for temple-minted coins. The money changers that Yeshua got so angry at were those merchants who bought those foreign coins from Jewish pilgrims for a low price and then exchanged them for temple coins at a price higher than their value. Of course, a hefty built-in commission was charged, and the high priest was complicit in all this nasty business so that he could make some profit for himself. Well, the next type of offering discussed is called firstlings. That is, it's in the sense of first fruits or firstborn. And the rule is that since all first fruits and all firstborns, in other words, firstborns being of animal or people, all of this by default belongs to the Lord, well, now you can't turn around and consecrate them. In other words, nobody can give to the Lord as a consecrated item something that's already been consecrated. You can't give something to God that God already owns. That said, this applies only to clean things, things that have been declared ritually clean, suitable for sacrifice. Unclean things, unclean animals in this case, can be consecrated to the Lord, but they must be redeemed and then the money given in its stead. As an example, a person can consecrate an unclean animal. Let's say they donate a camel to the temple, but that person has to redeem it. Or the priest can sell the animal to somebody else for money. However, the price that is charged has to be 20% above its regular market value. I suppose a reasonable question might be, why would a person go through such a strange process as to give an animal knowing they're going to have to turn around and redeem it? Why would they do that? Now, remembering we're dealing with an ancient culture full of customs and traditions, and that this was a farming and herding-based society, it might well be that the person gives an animal because he currently has no money. It is agreed that the animal will be held for a time until that person can come up with money to get it back. Verse 28 describes another kind of setting apart an item for God. Different Bibles use different words for this particular kind of giving. Some will say devote. Others will say proscribe. Our complete Jewish Bible says consecrate unconditionally. I don't have a problem with any of those words. What this is getting at is that in this particular type of setting apart an item for God, there can be no redemption. It's a permanent consecration. Now, the most important thing for us to recognize is not the somewhat arbitrary and loose choice of a word or a term for each kind of an offering, like a vow, or, and then consecrations, and then devote or prescribe, or so on. What's important is to see that there are a number of kinds, a number of classes, categories of giving things to God or setting things apart for God, each with its own sets of rules and regulations. The idea that we just mechanically give 10% of our income and now we're off the hook, or that we can see someone in need and simply look the other way because, well, I've already given, that's unknown in the Bible. It is further unknown that 10% is the final and rigid number. The tithe represents only a certain kind of giving, not the sum total of all giving. Now notice this seemingly out of place thought in verse 29. That speaks of no human who has been devoted or set apart can be ransomed. He has to be put to death. See, what's going on here is that this is just a Hebrew way of saying no one who has been given the death penalty for a capital crime can be redeemed for money. He has to die. It's kind of interesting the way this whole thing comes full circle. We're going along speaking about devoting, setting things apart for God. Gifts, offerings, good things, positive things. Then the scripture just throws someone into the whole mess who's committed a capital crime, a bad thing, a negative thing. What's being demonstrated here is that there is a connection between a person violating a very serious law of God and thus getting the death penalty and the setting aside of things for God. I want you to follow this because we're going to see how God and the Hebrew legal system views justice. We saw back in chapter 26 that when God makes a law, a regulation, he also sets down a blessing for those who are obedient to it, and then he also sets down a curse for those who are disobedient to it. The curse for the violation is of some of God's laws, some of them, is physical death. This is not a human determination. This is not a group of lawmakers sitting down and determining from their own personal sense of morality who ought to live and who ought to die. And for what? For doing what? This is God's determination as he gave it to Moses and as he set it down in the Torah. When God demands the life of the violator, that life becomes devoted to God. It's all bound up in the same principle that when a sheep or a bull is set apart for a sacrifice, the life of that animal is now considered devoted to God. When in the administration of justice, the person who has allegedly violated God's law, when he's found guilty, it's the judge's duty to confer the penalty that God has commanded upon that guilty party. The judge has no right to do anything else, no matter what his personal feelings might be, no matter what his personal sense of morality or sympathy might be. Not to do so makes the judge guilty of not obeying God. So it is not man who says, "You must die for committing murder." It's God. Man is simply being obedient according to God's laws when we execute a murderer today. A person who is to be killed for violating God's laws is, in God's eyes, being set apart for him in the sense that God is taking back the life that he first gave to that person. A life is the Lord's. This is why we have the Hebrew thought that a man who violates a capital crime and so receives capital punishment is in a sense atoning for his own guilt by means of his own life. And under most crimes against God, non-capital crimes, an animal substitute can be offered. The guilty man's sins are then transferred to the animal, and in turn, God accepts the life of that animal in place of the life of the guilty man. Therefore, in a way, that condemned man becomes God's holy property, just as the sacrificial animal becomes God's holy property. See, this principle being that whatever is set apart for God, whether it's the result of something positive or negative, it's God's. And whatever is God's is his holy property, and you don't mess with God's holy property. Now, the last rule discussed as a method of offering or setting apart for God is the tithe. And this verse speaks of two kinds: a tithe of the crops from the land, and a tenth or a tithe of the increase of the animals. Now understand, all of these different kinds of giving apply to an Israelite's life simultaneously. You don't get to choose from a menu. You don't get a list of options of which of these you'd like to give. They each apply according to a circumstance. So here, a tithe is just an automatic giving of a tenth of your increase, whatever form that increase might be, in addition to all the other types of giving and devotions of things to God that we've covered here. And since tithes were at first usually given in the form of animals or produce, later on in coins, then a person could redeem his tithed animals or produce by paying their equivalent in money plus a 20% surcharge. And what is also being described is that the tithe is to merely be a random sampling of his crops and his flocks and his herds. In other words, his tithe does not have to be picked out from only the best portion, nor is he permitted to pick out the worst portion to base his tithe on. The tithe is to be an honest representation of all that person has, balancing the good with the bad. This is entirely different than a first fruits offering or a ritual sacrifice by which only the best can be given to God. And further, as I stated, the tithe is in addition to the first fruits offerings and all the other kinds of giving as well. Now, let me conclude by pointing out, for the most part, that chapter 27 revolves around vows and commitments that somebody has made to Yahweh. In general, God is not seeking our vows. And when he is, our response is taken seriously. Changing one's mind is costly, generally a 20% penalty. Vows are not to be taken lightly. Now, naturally, this same exact principle carries over to the New Testament. And just as naturally, the New Testament doesn't re-explain it because it's already been previously explained. Rather, Yeshua takes the meaning of it to a deeper, to another level. For instance, he is saying it is better than swearing a vow, which involves all the stuff we've just been studying, to merely let your yes be yes and your no be no. Yeshua is pointing out what we can certainly see. Man, there is a major downside to making a vow to God, particularly if you're not very good at following through. This ends the book of Leviticus, the book of the priesthood. Next week, we begin the truly awesome book of Numbers.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.